This is the takeaway for Thursday, July 2nd, 2015.
This is the takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And this is a Thursday that feels more like a Friday as we head into the 4th of July weekend. We've got some provocative conversations later this hour about how Muslim Americans envision their place in America and how much that has changed in just a few decades. Our latest installment of our series on religion and the environment takes us to a mosque in Southern California. Some somber reflections on the short, tragic life of Amy Winehouse and the persistent impact of slavery on descendants of slave owners. But we begin in Cairo. Is ISIS trying to take territory in Egypt? The coordinated assault by Islamic State-affiliated terrorists in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula comes 2 days after Egypt's top prosecutor was assassinated in a bombing in Cairo. The Egyptian military has launched airstrikes in the Sinai in response to the attacks. From Cairo is Karim Fahim, Middle East reporter for our partner, The New York Times. He says, once again, the Egyptian government is seen having difficulty with an insurgency that's been growing since the fall of President Mohamed Morsi.
Well, the attack yesterday, at the very least, shows that the government doesn't yet have an answer to this sort of broadening insurgency in the country, despite the fact that it's gone on for nearly 2 years now. They have faced sort of persistent attacks in the Sinai Peninsula from these jihadist groups, and then intermittent attacks that have grown more sophisticated in other parts of the country, including Cairo.
Does ISIS have a base in Cairo on any level? Could it mobilize from within?
I don't think we've seen any evidence that that's true yet. There is a group in the Sinai Peninsula that has affiliated itself with ISIS, but the degree of coordination between the Islamic State group in Iraq and Syria and the Egyptian group is not very well understood at this point. Some people have speculated that the sort of spectacular attack yesterday provided evidence of more coordination between the groups, but the Egyptian group remains fairly well rooted as a domestic militant organization, and you know, hasn't conducted the sort of attacks that we've become used to in Iraq and Syria that have killed sort of civilians en masse.
Remind us, Karim, the unique nature of the Sinai Peninsula, how sparsely populated it is, but yet it is a symbolic territory that relates to Gaza, Hamas, a number of constituencies.
Yeah, as you said, it is sparsely populated. You know, this insurgency has been rooted in the northern Sinai Peninsula, but I think more importantly than the connection to Gaza for some of the towns along the border area has been very important, and their sort of familial ties across the border. And had been sort of economic ties over the last couple of years because of the smuggling tunnels. But I think more importantly, it is an area that has been marginalized by the central government for a very long time. There is sort of a deeply woven sense of discontent there. And the sort of current military operations have only deepened that sense. You know, we know very little about the war in the Sinai. It's very, the government has made it very hard for journalists to visit there. And so, the long-term concern is that this sort of historical feeling of marginalization is only growing worse in the area.
So, Karim, if ISIS were to manage to plant a flag in the Sinai and be difficult to dislodge, the Egyptian government could easily keep the world from seeing that just by containing Sinai in the way that they've done, as you described.
I suppose that's true, but these attacks, which have occurred at regular intervals, have been very hard to hide. You know, they have killed dozens of soldiers at a time, every sort of 6 months or so, and there are families of these soldiers. There are funerals to be held. This isn't something you can just sort of sweep under the rug. I mean, I think what is much less well understood is the impact on the towns in the Sinai, on civilians in the Sinai, and the exact nature of the way the Egyptian government is conducting this war.
Karim Fahim from Cairo, Egypt, Middle East reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much, Karim.
Thanks for having me.
The other big story today, jobs numbers. The U.S. economy added 223,000 jobs in the month of June. The unemployment rate fell to 5.3% from 5.5% in May. The news comes as President Obama travels to the University of Wisconsin at La Crosse to speak on the state of the economy and his newly announced plan to reset the salary threshold for eligible workers for overtime. Until this week, workers who made just over $23,000 per year got time and a half for working overtime. President Obama's new rule more than doubles that salary cap to more than $50,000, making nearly 5 million more Americans eligible for overtime pay. It's a far cry from what was imagined would be the impact of the Fair Labor Standards Act, which back in 1938, under Franklin Delano Roosevelt, established the minimum wage and the concept of a national overtime standard.
Except perhaps for the Social Security Act, it is the most far-reaching program, the most far-sighted program for the benefit of workers that has ever been adopted here or in any other country. Without question, it starts us towards a better standard of living and increases purchasing power to buy the products of farm and of factory.
Lawrence Michel, author of The State of Working America and president of the Economic Policy Institute, says President Obama's new overtime rules are an echo from the days of the Depression-era New Deal.
Well, the Fair Labor Standards Act is one of the great New Deal reforms passed in 1938. It's the same law that provides the minimum wage, and it's the same law that eliminated child labor. And we've been building on that ever since. The problem is that some of the protections to get overtime have really diminished over time. In 1975, about 62% of salaried workers were eligible for overtime. And in recent years, it's been only about 8%. So that is what the administration is trying to solve with this new proposed regulation.
And did the Fair Labor Standards Act enshrine the 8-hour day as something of an absolute? And who was determined to be eligible for overtime back then, and who is eligible today? What kind of worker?
Well, it did solidify the 8-hour day back in the Great Depression, and I think it was a way also to try to create work so that a lot of people didn't have overtime. The work would be done by other people who would have employment. The scope of coverage of the Fair Labor Standards Act expanded quite a lot over the ensuing years, so that by the early 1960s, it covered the entire economy. It covered a smaller part of the economy in the 1930s. Too many people today, though, think that they are not eligible to overtime just because they're paid a salary rather than by the hour. That's not true. You don't get overtime if you are an executive, administrative, or professional worker, and if you earn more than $23,660. That's the current rule. And if you have those kinds of responsibilities, you know, employers can not provide overtime. But the definition of the ability of employers to decide who has supervisory responsibilities has been expanded and has been kind of a gray area. And so in practice, I think very few salaried workers are getting overtime protections at this point.
I mean, it's become this strange situation where, you know, hey there, Mr. Worker, the good news is we're promoting you to management, and the bad news is you're not going to get any overtime anymore. And, you know, this question of feeling like whether you're managing anything seems to be a workaround for the whole idea of overtime. Is that the way employers have used the Fair Labor Standards Act, promoting people into positions where they don't have to pay them overtime?
Well, that does happen quite a lot. There's lots of instances of people who are managing stores, working 60 hours a week, where they spend most of their time actually being cashiers or stocking shelves or unloading trucks. And what that means is that your hours after 40 are free. And when that happens, then employers are going to use a lot of them. When something is cheap, people buy a lot of it. That's a law of economics. And it means they don't have to respect the time of those managers. I think many of these people that get these jobs that then work all these hours, you know, they weren't told when they got the job that that was what was going to be expected of them or that's what the situation was going to demand. So I think basically getting overtime protection requires that employers really respect the time of their all their employees. And what it'll do is the people who now are working all these long hours will work less hours. They'll probably get some overtime pay, but some of the work is going to be done by hourly workers and part-time workers who maybe will be able to get a full-time job out of it.
Is there a formal process for petitioning to get overtime under the Fair Labor Standards Act? I mean, could some manager in a 7-Eleven in North Dakota who has to work, as you say, 20 hours at a stretch, petition to get overtime, even though they're called the manager of the store?
Well, I think they have to talk to their employer. They could access the Wage and Hours Division of the Department of Labor. There may be laws that apply in the particular state.
So in theory, they can do this, but I mean, it sort of scares me to imagine.
In practice, people are intimidated. The Department of Labor, in its report this week, said that one of the big misunderstandings is that both employers and employees think that if you're paid a salary, you're not eligible for overtime. That's not true. And that's what one of the great benefits of this new rule, which is saying that right now, if you earn under $23,660, you are automatically eligible for overtime. That's a very low salary. That's equivalent to the poverty line for a family of four. The department is proposing lifting that salary threshold to $50,440. So what this means is that everybody will know that if you basically earn under $50,000, you're eligible, salaried or not, except if you're in a few specific occupations that are excluded. You know, what it does is it makes it clear where people stand, both to the employee and the employers. And I think it'll give people more protection, more access to overtime, more ability to protect their own rights.
Talking about the history of what we once called tasty overtime, time and a half pay, and the work rules that the Obama administration has changed to have an impact on middle-class workers, Lawrence Michel is author of The State of Working America and president of the Economic Policy Institute. Lawrence, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills like physics, photography, and parkour. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at curious.com/PRI.
Actor Ben Affleck apparently has bigger things to worry about than his slave-owning ancestors. He's getting divorced from his wife of 10 years, Jennifer Garner, and has asked for privacy at a difficult time. But he made a different kind of request for privacy months ago when he discovered details about his slave-owning ancestors through the PBS series Finding Your Roots. He quietly requested that they be removed, and when emails discussing the omission between Affleck and the series host producer Henry Louis Gates Jr. were eventually leaked to the public, it looked as though a celebrity was trying to pick and choose a history that didn't belong to just him. Affleck, in a statement of regret, claimed he was embarrassed. But history is full of embarrassments, prejudices, and strands from our troubled past that can be seen in so many of the news stories we speak about every day. Writer Preston Merchant learned some time ago that he is the great-great-grandson of one Captain William Young Con Hannum, a slave owner in Maryville, Tennessee, just outside of Knoxville. Merchant says he can't escape that history, and unlike Affleck, he says he doesn't want to erase it. But just as the violence in Charleston has reignited a debate over the Confederate flag's place in modern America, Merchant has had to confront, once again, his own family identity.
Well, I think every Southern family has a history that it needs to deal with in some fashion. You know, certainly slavery is inescapable in the histories of Southern families on both sides, the slave owners and the slaves themselves, and these families' histories are intertwined. My own family, it's difficult to talk about. Certainly, you know, modern people are appalled that our family owned slaves as property in the past. And yet, you know, we haven't really come to terms with what it meant for individual families to have been slave owners.
So what's our responsibility here? And I was looking into my own background.
to try to figure out if there was any way, because my family goes way back to like the original Dutch settlers of New York. I couldn't find anything either way, one way or another. I'm haunted to ask myself, what is our responsibility here?
I think our responsibility is to understand our history. I think it's natural for anyone to want to look for their ancestors in the historical record and to find out that they mattered somewhere along the way. And in investigating that record, we are all bound to find that our ancestors were involved in things that we would consider today morally repellent. Certainly, if you are investigating a history of a family in the South, you're going to come into contact with the Civil War and with the issue of slavery. It's not something that we should hide or run from or try to bury or create as a kind of nostalgia for a time past. But certainly to understand where we came from, the history of race relations in the United States, especially the South. As we all know, these issues are operative today, certainly, and we've seen it with the shootings in Charleston and the controversy over the Confederate flag. So the past informs these issues, and personal histories and family histories certainly inform them as well.
Do you have any feelings about what Ben Affleck did in the PBS documentary series?
Yes, I was curious about that. I can't speak to his personal views, but I can understand why, you know, not wanting to be on record as having it known that your family owned slaves is certainly an understandable position.
But to insist upon that, to the extent that you would actually alter the historical, I don't know, chronicle of a major documentary, especially if you're a filmmaker, just seems like, I don't know, it seems like a very dark thing to have done. What would you have done in that situation?
Well, like I say, my family's record is very clear. I am a descendant of William Young Conn Hanum, who was a captain in the Confederate Army. He was from Maryville, Tennessee, that's near Knoxville, and he went off to the war and fought in the Army of Northern Virginia under Stonewall Jackson. He was wounded at the Battle of Cedar Run, and as an officer, he had taken with him as his valet a slave named Charles Boyd. And as the story goes, when Captain Hanum was wounded, he refused the services of the ambulance corps and called for Boyd to carry him to the field hospital. These details are preserved as a record in his service at Virginia Military Institute. And then later in some newspaper articles around the time of Boyd's death in 1917. The local United Daughters of the Confederacy chapter in Maryville is named after Captain Hanum. And, you know, of course, a local war hero had his record preserved in the tales and stories about his life also. So, I mean, it's there, and it makes for a compelling story, but it is nonetheless problematic and troubling. And, you know, I can understand why Ben Affleck, if he didn't know all these details, would be a little hesitant to have them revealed.
And your relative, Captain Hanum, and this slave Boyd, do you have any idea what that bond must have been like if he refused an ambulance to have Charles Boyd?
Well, I can only speculate. These two men were roughly the same age. Hanum entered the war at age 20, and Boyd seems to have been, according to census data, only about 4 years older. So these were two young men gone off to war together. Boyd was his personal valet behind the lines, helping him into his uniform and making his bed, I assume. But also, according to some other data, he was a bit of a messenger, riding with orders and messages around Hanum's company. So he played a role. The United Daughters of Confederacy chapter in Maryville, Tennessee, honored Boyd later as a forgotten Confederate, a black man who had served the Confederate cause. So the stories suggest that there was a great personal bond between these two men, and it's easy to imagine, and of course one wants to believe it. So, yes, families that own slaves, you know, in this great tragic and unfortunate period in American history, they lived in close contact with each other, and families were intertwined, and bonds of affection certainly grew.
Does it diminish your pride in your ancestor, these circumstances?
I don't think it does. I mean, it's a fact of history. I can't do anything about it. I try not to judge it. It's something that we Americans have to struggle with, whether or not your family is directly connected to the slave system. That doesn't mean that we are not bound to try to learn from this, try to investigate it, understand the issues, move forward with race relations, you know, not let something like this inform the negative aspects of our lives.
Does the Confederate flag fly over the history of your family for all time, or can you pull it down?
Well, I think we have pulled it down. I think it has meant different things to different generations. It has become uncompromisingly negative. And I don't see a way to separate its negative symbolism from what it had been, which is to say a nostalgia for a lost time.
Preston Merchant, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Preston Merchant is a photographer and adjunct professor at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism in New York City. In the dark times of old, the world was engulfed in foulness and decay. The waters receded, the bitter rains fell. Civilization was powerless in the face of steadily rising temperatures, and lands and cities that had thrived for hundreds of years vanished without a trace. The one called Pope Francis tried to unite all of the faithful, but those who called themselves Muslims reminded him that long ago they had quietly begun building their own fortress of followers to protect the planet. In this latest installment of our real-life saga about religion and the environment, a series we're calling God's Plan, Faith Communities Mobilize on the Environment, we look today at the history of environmental protection in Islam. How is the message of caring for the planet conveyed in mosques by real imams with active congregations? Imam Mustafa Omar is Education and Outreach Director at the Islamic Institute of Orange County in California. We spoke to him this week in the middle of his fasting during Ramadan, and he told us the timing of the Pope's encyclical is an invitation for the members of his mosque to think about their responsibility to the earth.
When it came out, we said, Alhamdulillah, which means praise be to God. We said, you know, this it's about time that we have a large organization, international organization like the church, speaking out on something like this. There's a term in the Quran that's used. It's called the word Khalifa, which is not used in a political sense as head of state, but in the linguistic sense, it means somebody who's a deputy acting on behalf of somebody else. So human beings are described in the Quran as being a khalifa acting on behalf, a deputy acting on behalf of God. So while we're here, we have this privilege, and this privilege comes with a responsibility. And that responsibility is you can use the things that God has created, but you can't abuse them. And that's part of our test in life. So there's a lot of doctrines that you find in the Quran, and you find in the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad, where he talks about, you know, if you're using water, even if you're at the bank of a river, don't waste that water, right? Because somebody else could have utilized it after you. So the emphasis on responsibility and not wasting things, not destroying things, not corrupting things, causing corruption in the land and in the seas and all of these things, they're themes that are common throughout the Quran and throughout the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad.
Do you think the fact that the encyclical was released at the same day as the first day of Ramadan was significant? Did it seem as though there was a embrace or a reaching out there from the Vatican?
Yeah, I'm not actually sure about that, to be honest with you. I'm kind of glad that it was, though. Ramadan is a time where, you know, where Muslims are fasting, and they're actually learning through fasting and refraining from eating and drinking throughout the day. They're actually learning a level of self-control. And that's important because when it comes to these environmental issues, it does require a level of self-control to be able to take your cup and hold on to it and walk to a trash can until you can throw it away in the right place, or find a recycle bin and throw it into the recycling, or to make sure that, you know, you don't throw something on the floor, or you don't, you know, take more food than you can eat or something like that. So I think, you know, it is interesting that it comes in the month of Ramadan, and Ramadan is actually the time where the mosques are full of worshippers around the entire world, in America and all the other Muslim countries and even non-Muslim countries. So this is a perfect opportunity for us as imams, as religious leaders, to actually remind our congregation, to remind the Muslims that we have a responsibility to the environment. We have a responsibility to make sure that in our individual capacity, we're doing what we need to do and not doing something which is actually going to end up hurting the environment, it's going to be hurting the earth. And at the same time, we need to be vocal and we need to be active and educate other people about what's actually happening so that we're not in violation of the principles of Islam that were taught in the Quran.
Imam Mustafa, if you've observed the reaction among some Christian politicians, conservative Christian politicians, to what the Pope has said, that he should mind his own business and leave science to the scientists, how have people responded in your community, in the Muslim community generally, to the idea of Islam and environmental consciousness?
Yeah, I mean, we kind of laugh off some of those more extreme comments because it's the science that's actually pointing to the fact that the environment is in danger. So when they're trying to dismiss something like this, it's pretty clear to see that they're driven more by prophets, P-R-O-F-I-T-S, rather than the followings and the teachings of the prophets, P-R-O-P-H-E-T-S. So it's something that, you know, it's of concern that people are dismissing this, especially people who we expect that their moral framework and their, you know, moral background would support an encyclical like this. And actually, they should be jumping on board and they should be happy about something like this. But instead, they seem to be upset. But when it comes down to it, it depends on what you, you know, what you do shows what you really believe in the depth of your heart. And I think that's coming out in the open now. It's becoming more transparent.
The relationship between the people of God and the people of science has often been a divisive one, and that down through history, science has been used as a way to divide all faiths. Do you think there's a chance that this issue, that climate change and the environment, could be a moment for reversing that, for in fact coming together in a way that hasn't really been seen among all the faiths since, you know, 1,000 years ago?
Well, first of all, I would say that may have been the case in, you know, medieval Europe among Christendom. But in Islamic history, there's never been this divide between the scientists and the Muslim scholars or the religion. You know, they've always been in quite good harmony. If you look throughout the golden age of Islam in Baghdad and in Spain and all these different regions. But in terms of now, yes, this is a great opportunity. I think that they can unite on something. In the sense that, well, see, science is just going to simply point to the problem and show, like, this is a major issue, this is a problem. Science, from the religious perspective, from the Islamic perspective, is not going to be making moral judgments. And from an Islamic perspective, we're going to step in and say, no, you know what? Yeah, there are blessings in life. God has created certain things for us, but we're not supposed to abuse them to the extent where they could be gone. We may not have anything for the next generation to even have left. They're not going to have any of these blessings. And we can, you know, we can find alternative ways to benefit from the resources that we've been provided without destroying them for the future generations.
Imam Mustafa Umar, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Imam Mustafa Umar is Education and Outreach Director at the Islamic Institute of Orange County, California. He spoke with us from public radio station KUCI in Irvine.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
We end this hour by exploring a complicated idea of home. It's also a very American idea of longing for home and discovering a new home. Kenan Trbinovic's family was chased from Bosnia by war in the 1990s. He ended up in suburban Connecticut, a place to wait, he thought, and then return to a peaceful Bosnia. But when peace came, his country, his home, was gone.
November 21st, remember 1995, they signed the Dayton Peace Accord. And I went outside and I was bouncing a basketball. I was so sad because I thought, I'm never going to see my cousin, I'm going to see my aunt. I'll probably never kiss a girl from home. Now I'm like stuck in this suburb. Only until I went to college, I started to feel like sense of like belonging. And I started to feel more American in the way also like thinking. And feels like, you know, in the blink of an eye, I just see myself as an American. I can't really see myself living anywhere else for now.
This journey to America and the inner journey to become an American takes many twists and turns for Muslims like Kenan. There's comedian and Muslim Aladdin Ola, who grew up in Harlem, the son of a Bengali steamship worker who landed in New York in the 1930s and lived alongside black and Puerto Rican immigrants. He thought he was 100% American until 9/11 tagged him as something even he didn't recognize.
On the 100th Street and Broadway, there were people outside. I can't make this up, man. It was Afghan kebab. And they were outside, like, you know, with picket signs saying, go back to your country, go back to your country. And I was like, the people who work at Afghan Kebab aren't even Afghani, they're Pakistani. So, like, I would go there and say, buy something, hook me up, because I would support them. And, like, I would come out, and people were like, go back to your country, like, you know, screaming at me. I'm like, yo, man, I live across the street. What's wrong with you? And, like, people were losing their mind.
Saadia Shepherd's mother was raised Muslim, her father was raised Christian, and her Pakistani grandmother was raised Jewish. Saadia's daughter is now on a journey to see what the mixing of all these religions will mean for her life. Saadia has discovered that she is not only the mother of a young girl, she's the matriarch of the family of identities she carries inside.
My daughter is now growing up in New York City and is only 2.5, but I think it's tremendously exciting to me. She just the other day, she pointed out on the globe, she said, Mama, this is Pakistan. And she has a name that, her name is Noor Jahan, which is a name that is recognizable in Pakistan. And that was a choice that we made with the hope that it would in some way kind of build a little bit of a bridge for her, even for an American, pretty pale kid. She said to me yesterday, she said, Mama, I'm pink and you're brown.
These three Muslim Americans gathered recently before a live audience in the WNYC Green Space to speak of how their identity as Americans is evolving as the profile of Islam has dramatically emerged in the United States during their lifetimes. They're all writers who think about this quite a lot. So with the 4th of July holiday right around the corner, a look now at the declarations of independence Muslims have had to make as they find their place in America.
I think it can be a confusing thing, but also I think it's a tremendous privilege to be a product of multiple places. And the chance to travel back and forth to Pakistan in my life has been absolutely essential. And I feel a tremendous connection and curiosity to other kinds of bicultural stories. As Pakistan, in the course of my lifetime, I mean, when I was a small child in the 80s going back and forth to Pakistan, it was a very different situation than it is now. I mean, Pakistan is going through a crisis right now, and you're seeing unprecedented levels of sectarian conflict and violence, rising terrorism, just the security concerns alone that doing something as simple as going to, say, a family wedding, like I describe in the book, is just it's a completely changed landscape. And one of the things that has shifted so much in Pakistan in just in my lifetime is that when I was a kid and visited Pakistan, we weren't the only Americans who were visiting, or we certainly weren't the only Westerners visiting. Now, if you're walking down the street in Karachi, it's a truly strange thing because people are like, what are you doing here? Why are you here? You can understand that people are, understand these differences.
When I went back in 2011, I felt like I recapture like part of my heart I left there, and I realized that I didn't belong there anymore because things just weren't the same. I mean, everything looked way smaller. Obviously, I was smaller, so it took 10 minutes to get somewhere instead of an hour. People also changed. They see you as an outsider, and they feel that you don't understand them. They feel that some see you as a deserter. I was 11 years old. How can I desert? But we see the situation better than they do within inside. And it's like one big state of denial. There's never any apology, acknowledgement, reparation. And I just wouldn't see myself living in that kind of society. Like, I live in the story of Queens, where there's a big Bosnian population. And I can have a dual life and double identity where I have my Bosnian friends with whom I hang out all the time. But I have my American friends. So one day I can have my Bosnian friends with Bosnian food, and I can just get on the subway and head to West Village and see my American friends.
Really, the better question is, who's the arbiter of what you are? Because my father's background was kind of comical, because when he came to America at the time, before partition, he was Indian. So in 1947, when India got partitioned independent, then he was East Pakistani. So then after 1971, he was Bangladeshi. But throughout the whole 50 years, all his relatives thought he was American. And my father's the least American you'll ever meet. So, you know, it's interesting because depending on whose perspective, what are you? I feel like every time I do shows for young kids who are Islamic or I'm like, I'm the last person you should be asking about religion. That's first of all. But I always tell them that to embrace, if you're getting bullied or people are persecuting you or saying nasty things, you know, it's like, you know, haters gotta hate. But you have to kind of embrace the fact that hatred comes with the package. And that if people are going to hate on you, that's something that you have to kind of get a better vest. People are dictating to you what you should be And the most difficult thing to be is yourself. And the irony about America is that the people who are telling you to go back to your country, it's like, you know, there's like a 92-year-old Native American going, no, why don't you go back to your country? So, you know, that's why you have to kind of look at who's the one that's pointing fingers and telling you who you should be or what you are.
I think it's a really interesting question, especially, I mean, of course, we're talking about multiple identities being from different places, but we're also talking about Muslim American identity. And I think there is something in our sort of collective American culture or consciousness where we feel that Muslim identity is synonymous with a religiously observant practice. Yeah. It's not, I think, an expectation that we bring to being, say, Jewish or Christian. You know, so if somebody they grew up going to church but they don't go to church anymore, you know, I don't think I say to them, oh, but you're not really Christian. But I think that there is an expectation collectively, and I think that we all, you know, that question of sort of like, well, who's more Muslim or not? Who's more? What does Muslim American mean? And obviously. Obviously, it means radically different things to different people.
Yes, I mean, I grew up culturally Muslim, and you know, I'm definitely, you know, well versed in that world because I grew up in it. But I think if you talk to people who grew up Muslim, I mean, I know Muslims that smoke weed and getting on my case that I'm an atheist. So it's like being Muslim doesn't mean one thing. And this is where I think the mass media has hijacked the conversation, making only about fundamentalism or one thing. The way we grew up, or, I mean, all three of us grew up totally different, but we would identify as saying we were culturally Muslim. And that's something that I think mass media, is my opinion. I don't think they want to show that.
Aladin Ullah, Kenan Trbinovich, Sadia Shepherd. They were all in conversation with the Takeaways' Maithili Rao at the Green Space. For a link to a video of that entire event, head over to thetakeaway.org. That's all for today. If you missed anything, go to thetakeaway.org and you can listen to the whole program. And ahead of the 4th of July weekend, we visit the World Trade Center site tomorrow to take a closer look at what patriotism means in 2015, an hour-long special called Tales from the Towers. Listen back to anything on this program ever that you ever hear at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.